Good morning. In the name of our mother, in memory of our brother Jesus, and in the energy of spirit, greetings. This Advent season, we are employing a lectionary guide gifted to us years ago by Prem Dick of blessed memory. Each week, we focus on an African-American spiritual and related Bible texts. This week, my thoughts have been on the parallels between ancient and modern economies of terror and on the human families that they dismember. I didn't get the sermon title into the bulletin, but I've given it a title that starts with a hyphenated word, Remembering the Disposable Baby Jesus. Ancient Egyptian elites considered themselves civilized, what we would call ladies and gentlemen, the owning class, the investors, the deserving, the stimulators of international economy. They were so civilized that they could read and write and invest in massive works of art. Their brilliant architects and accountants were accomplished mathematicians. They excelled in the kind of math that could predict the angle of the sun on a certain day and build an ornate temple to catch its rays in an inner sanctum at a prescribed moment. Projects of this scale were not possible without the management skills of slave drivers and their camp commandants and commissaries. Egypt's accountants and think tanks and advisors, parentheses, see the Genesis story of Joseph, the vizier, managed a growth economy fed by a constant diet of humans. Egypt's economy was not vegetarian. It digested Hebrew lives, it drank their blood and sweat, and ate their babies. When it had more than it could eat in a given year, it legally defined the leftover slave babies as disposable babies. Parentheses, see the Exodus story of Moses, the throwaway baby. Pyramids, built by Egypt's carnivorous economy, kept making the seven wonders of the world list for centuries. If there was a God at that time, and if godness is glory, fame, dominion, ownership, and power now and forever, well, then it should go without saying that God was a leading sponsor of the pharaohs and the supreme model of the gentlemanly ability to calculate the economic equations that make a civilization superior to a mere culture or tribe. Equations that turn slave labor camp inmates from humans into statistics. Cost versus benefit analyses that present peasant die-offs as, quote, worth it when weighed against the importance of maintaining what the investor class would call its high standard of living. For a recent deployment of the phrase worth it in this context, remember Secretary of State Madeleine Albright's economical answer to an interviewer asking what she thought of reports that 500,000 Iraqi children had died as a result of United Nations sanctions on Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was a Herod-type strongman, admired and supported by U.S. power brokers like Donald Rumsfeld in the 1980s, but who later fell out of favor. Madeline's reply to the question about the children. She said, this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it. But the Hebrew Bible begs to differ from this sort of straightforward, self-evident God logic or theology as it worked in the Egyptian Empire. The Hebrew Bible keeps alive a memory of God as a partisan for the oppressed and as the opponent of the predator classes who owned everyone else's means of survival and who measured their own dignity by their investments and by their consumption, while disregarding the families they dismembered and brutalized. So in the Hebrew Bible, see Leviticus and Deuteronomy for explicit Israelite legislation calling for the cancellation of long-term debts, legislation against lending money at interest, against demanding large collateral, and against retaining another family's land deeds for any period longer than 50 years. The Hebrew Psalms were composed and sung by exiled people whose communities had been dismembered by the rape, murder, and refugee status that always accompanies wars, both ancient and modern. They were written to resist the theologies of empires. Many of the Psalms argue that God sides with the victims in a world where injustice prevails. Psalm singers in alien lands were remembering themselves, remembering themselves as part of God's economy, a very different economy from Pharaoh's and Nebuchadnezzar's. Herod's temple was built more than two centuries after Philo of Alexandria issued the final listings for seven wonders of the world, but it certainly rivaled many of them, and it could not have been built and supplied without reformatting the economy of Palestine around it. Reformatting is my euphemism for what historians like Jared Diamond in his book Guns, Germs, and Steel call the transition from egalitarianism to kleptocracy. And kleptocracy means rule by thieves, a system designed for the rich to constantly steal from the poor. Jesus is reported to have begun his ministry by announcing the arrival of the debt-canceling, prison-breaking jubilee, mentioned in our first hymn today, prescribed in Leviticus and pictured in Isaiah. Parentheses, see Luke chapter 4 and Mark Clatterbuck's This I Believe sermon from this pulpit a few weeks ago. In contrast to those of his neighbors who aspired to imitate the predator classes, Jesus preached the sudden arrival of the economic regime of a God who sustains lilies and sparrows without destroying their environment in the process. In an age when the Mediterranean owners and managers of large estates worked by slave labor considered their investments to be a measure of their dignity, Jesus adopted a Hebrew prophetic stance which reversed the order of membership in God's family. Jesus perversely insisted that the poor were birthright members of God's regime or economy, and that the rich investors in the Roman economy, which consumed and dismembered the poor, were excluding themselves from God's community. Rome's theology, its understanding of how God runs the world, was a straightforward recognition that the Caesars, the Kaisers, were participants in the sort of domination that separates gods and godlings from mere humans. Augustus Caesar, most famously, was called the Son of God. His biography was distributed throughout the empire as a gospel, that's what it was called. So when Jesus' followers called him the Son of God, they were treasonously and blasphemously alleging that a victim of Roman judicial murder in the outlying colony of Palestine was actually a truer access point to the reality of who God is than any other person or moment in the entire Mediterranean world. And that theological treason prevented many of them from pledging allegiance to the Roman regime. Jesus' crucifixion was neither unique nor special. It was horribly routine for rabble-rousers, slaves, and terrorists. And from the perspective of anyone who has literally invested in the Roman definition of Pax Romana, endless war for endless peace, endless slavery for endless economic growth. For a person like that, a vision like Jesus preached is not cute or naive. It is a source of real terror. It threatens all of one's core values and signals the end of the world as we know it. Jesus died the death of a terrorist. Jesus was not the first or last Palestinian peasant to publicly label Herod a predator. Jesus called him a fox. Or to point out that self-styled so-called benefactors were actually predators. That's Jesus recorded in Luke 22:25. No, many other people talked like him, and for that reason, Roman legions carried out 3 internal crusades against Jewish infidels, by which I mean people who are unfaithful to the Caesar's vision for the colony of Palestine. These 3 internal crusades occurred in the years 4, before the current era, 4 BC, 66 of our current era, and the year 132 of the current era. And they involved countless wooden crosses. Jesus grew up in Nazareth, 4 miles from where the center of the 4 BCE atrocities occurred when the Syrian legions, who were supposed to be protecting against the Parthians, were redeployed to move south and hammer the Galileans. John Crossan says it is easy to imagine that Mary would have told Jesus about the day the Romans came to traumatize the land of his birth around the time he was born. It thus makes perfect sense that when Matthew, in the late first century, composed his account of Jesus' career and its meaning, he would imaginatively present Jesus as a terrorist threat to Herod from the very beginning. The scripture we read for today is perhaps not very Christmassy. Matthew's nativity scene is vividly drawn around the organizing theme of paranoid executive narcissism and its deadly consequences for children. Jesus is pictured as escaping the lethal policing by Herod's elite insecurity forces only by means of an angelic intervention and a night flight to a neighboring province. African-American spirituals were composed and sung by a people who were enslaved in large and small labor camps throughout several former British colonies. They are the soul-deep psalms of a kidnapped people whose communities had been dismembered by the rape, murder, and repeated displacement that fed the digestive system of the fastest-growing economy in the world at that time. They were written to resist the straightforward theology of American empire, the white theology that defined Africans as manifestly destined for perpetual enslavement. Daryl Pinkney says, quote, "In the savage, undreamed of slave system in the New World, Africans were physically and mentally subjugated, then worked to death, and then replaced. Only when the enslaved labor population began to be maintained by reproduction and not by the importation of replacements were they given enough to eat, to sustain life, and that was more than 100 years after Louis XIV's Black Codes licensed barbarism in the Caribbean." It's the end of the quote from Daryl Pinkney. Now, I've never been to Europe myself, so I've never visited Auschwitz or Dachau. But from what I've read from people who have, it sounds like the tour guides do not spend the bulk of the time pointing out majestic grand staircases in the homes of camp commandants or admiring silverware collections of their very civilized wives. For that sort of orientation of a camp tour, that sort of celebratory take on the whole thing, I think you'd be better off visiting Dixie, the land of King Cotton. The counter-revolution of 1776 was sparked by elite North American colonists when they feared that two catastrophes were near at hand. Catastrophe number one, the British abolition of slavery. Catastrophe number two, British enforcement of treaties with Native Americans living west of the Appalachian Mountains. The counter-revolutionary militias were skillfully led by George, a descendant of that John Washington, who had been known to the Susquehannock peoples as Conotocarius, destroyer of villages. George, a former ally of Redcoats, when they were slaughtering French colonists and many of the seed of Manitou, the vulnerable people that we sang about in hymn number 190. George turned his coat to blue and was successful in preventing an outbreak of justice for slaves and Native Americans, and he successfully secured the blessings of liberty for enslavers and their posterity. Within a few years, the Articles of Confederation were discarded, and a more perfect union was formed by means of what historian David Waldstreicher has shown to be slavery's constitution in his book by that title. From the 1619 project that Susan mentioned in her sermon last week, published online by New York Times, from part of an essay by Matthew Desmond, what made the cotton economy boom in the United States and not in all the other far-flung parts of the world with climates and soil suitable to the crop was our nation's unflinching willingness to use violence on non-white people and to exert its will on seemingly endless supplies of land and labor, given the choice between modernity and barbarism, prosperity and poverty, lawfulness and cruelty, democracy and totalitarianism. Desmond says, America chose all of the above. One of the most important books I've read in the past 3 years is Edward E. Baptist's book, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. Baptist helps us to see the direct connection between images like this, the repeatedly ripped open back of an enslaved American whose ancestors were kidnapped from Africa, to encourage him to pick more cotton than he knew how to do, or to discourage him from running away. Connection between images like that and images of accounting like this. It'd be a fun thought experiment to imagine the common practices of double entry accounting and asset depreciation and these kinds of things that make for a modern economy just kind of evolving on their own out of nowhere. But that thought experiment would be entirely irrelevant. The capitalism we actually have reached its fastest state of evolution and strongest growth during this time period in this context. This image is the planter's annual record of his Negroes on the Pleasant Hill Plantation during the year 1850. There are lists of the names of humans here. Males on this side, females on this side. This column is the value at commencement of the year, and then the next column is value at the end of the year. So there's careful asset accounting here, and there's gradual depreciation over the lifetime of a slave. When seeking loans, planters on plantations, I'm sure you've heard these euphemisms, used enslaved people as collateral. Thomas Jefferson mortgaged 150 of his enslaved workers to build Monticello. Now that's where I have been on. I was a wide-eyed teenager. I really enjoyed it. So that's a golden memory. People could be sold so much more easily than land, and in multiple southern states, more than 8 in 10 mortgage-secured loans used enslaved people as full or partial collateral. As the historian Bonnie Martin has written, slave owners worked their slaves financially as well as physically from colonial days until emancipation by mortgaging people to buy more people. Global financial markets got in on the action. When Thomas Jefferson mortgaged his enslaved workers, it was a Dutch firm that put up the money. The Louisiana Purchase, which opened millions of acres to cotton production, was financed by Baring Brothers, the well-heeled British commercial bank. A majority of the credit powering the American slave economy came from the London money market. Years after abolishing the African slave trade in 1807, Britain and much of Europe along with it was bankrolling slavery in the United States. Some historians have claimed that the British abolition of slave trade was a turning point in modernity, marked by the development of a new kind of moral consciousness when people began considering the suffering of others thousands of miles away. But perhaps all that changed was a growing need to scrub the blood of enslaved workers off of American dollars, British pounds, and French francs, a need that Western financial markets fast found a way to satisfy through the global trade in bank bonds. Here was a means to profit from slavery without getting your hands dirty. Call it irony, coincidence, or maybe cause. Historians haven't settled the matter, but avenues to profit indirectly from slavery grew in popularity as the institution of slavery itself grew more unpopular. Sorry, I failed to credit that the last long section I was reading there was, again, from that 1619 project, Desmond's essay. Edward Baptist describes how camp accountants kept careful records of slaves' daily cotton picking in their ledgers and rationally, calmly prescribed public whippings to force them to pick cotton faster. Dixie's booming economy, to quote Baptist, looted the riches of black folks' minds, stole days and months and years and lifetimes, turned sweat, blood, and flesh into gold. The U.S. became a world power thanks to, in his words, an economy whose bottom gear was torture. Henry Bibbs's owner, for example, said that he was no better pleased than when he could hear the sound of the driver's lash among the toiling slaves, for then he knew that his system was working. Southern agribusiness camp managers used a creative variety of torture technology to stimulate the American economy, and I won't read the long list of variety that Baptist provides, but just four of the items included branding irons, pokers, electric shocks, and waterboarding. Baptist says, enslaved migrants in the field soon learned what happened if they lagged or resisted. In Mississippi, Alan Sidney saw a man who had fallen behind fight back against a black driver who had tried to whip him up to pace. The white overseer on horseback dropped his umbrella, and here I just want to insert, that's a sign of gentility, higher standard of living, upper class, to have an umbrella to protect yourself from the sun. Dropped his umbrella, spurred up his horse, and shouted, "Take him down!" The overseer pulled out a pistol and shot the prone man dead. None of the other slaves, Sidney remembered, said a word or turned their heads. They kept on hoeing as if nothing had happened. My spouse is a stronger human than I am, and so she has watched Schindler's List, that famous movie, several times. I've only been able to watch it once. But when I read this passage in Baptist's book 3 years ago, the image that popped into my mind was the one from Schindler's List with the camp commandant doing some sniper rifle target practice from his back deck. History never repeats itself, and there are no exact equivalencies between different camps, but there are some really horrifying parallels. American investors in slavery considered themselves to be every bit as elite and civilized as any ancient class of owners. They named one chamber of Congress the Senate. Oliver Wendell Holmes, the father of a later Supreme Court justice, was proud of the fact that the U.S. was not just another tribe or culture or nation, as in people group, but was a lethal colonial settler state. In 1858, he announced in his book, The Autocrat of the Breakfast Table, that we are the Romans of the modern world, the great assimilating people, Conflicts and conquests are, of course, necessary accidents with us, as with our prototypes." End quote. Our lectionary resource for today points out that it was illegal for enslaved persons to read. So they heard about the travelers carrying gifts to Bethlehem and included that star story in the story of the shepherds, which occurs in Luke's gospel. So the spiritual that we're looking at this morning combines two different Bible stories. Hebrew shepherds in Egypt were despised by civilized Egyptians and sent to segregated housing in Goshen. African Americans could identify with that. African Americans could also identify with the peasant shepherds of Jesus' day, who were stuck in a dirty, isolating job, not unlike being a slave. The lectionary guide points out that if the master had really been listening to the song that China's been singing for us, the song would have been banned, just as the drum had been banned. Slaveholders from New England to the southern regions, especially Virginia, were all too aware that the enslaved had made plans to rise up, as the song says, since the 1660s. This song is not only about the birth of Jesus. For many, the star in the east represented Polaris, the North Star. In many African American spirituals, heaven referred to Africa, Canada, and the northern United States. Frederick Douglass wrote about the double meaning of these spirituals. He said this: "A keen observer might have detected in our repeated singing of, 'O Canaan, sweet Canaan, I am bound for the land of Canaan,' something more than a hope of reaching heaven. We meant to reach the north, and the north was our Canaan." In his book, The Spirituals and the Blues, Black theologian James Cone said this: "White people achieved what they called dignity by their enslavement of black Africans. They measured their importance by the number of Africans they enslaved." End quote. By identifying their own pain with that of God's son Jesus, the enslaved contradicted the economic and legal system that rendered their lives disposable. They persistently remembered themselves as part of God's family, facing the same sorts of horrors that Moses and Jesus and other babies had faced. One white American enslaver wrote in a letter to her slave trading cousin, quote, "Gross has killed Sook's youngest child. He took the child out to work. It was between 1 year and 18 months old. And because it would not do its work to please him, he first whipped it and then held its head in the creek branch to make it hush crying." Black spirituals were a means for the oppressed to claim Jesus as a brother and to rebelliously remember themselves as members of part of God's illegal economy of grace. African American spirituals were produced by the bravest people on our continent in the same decades when Francis Scott Key so famously misrepresented the U.S. as the land of the free. Now, he got the brave part right. The African Americans were here. And for nearly two centuries, by the time he wrote that song, for nearly two centuries, African Americans have been surviving and sometimes thriving against an economy carefully engineered to render black lives disposable. So this Christmas, for which Americans is it most appropriate to identify their charming babies with the Palestinian Jewish babe in the manger? I have a three-sentence conclusion. The first sentence is a bit of a preachment, and the last two are a fragment of my personal testimony. If you are a Christian and a U.S. citizen and have not yet realized that Jesus is black, you do not yet understand the Hebrew Bible, You do not understand the Gospels, and your conscience may be a casualty of your middle school and high school American history classes. As for me, this, I believe, Black Lives Matter, and that is one reason why I cannot pledge allegiance to a piece of fabric and to the proud history for which it stands, one empire under surveillance with liberty and justice for whites.